Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, home of the modern whitetail hunter. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Hey everybody, welcome to Wired to Hunt episode 426. I'm your guest host, Tony Peterson, and today I'm talking to Jeremy Moore about tracking deer with dogs and all of the cool ways that dogs can help you become a better hunter. Hey everybody, welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, which is brought to you by First Light. You might notice that this voice does not sound like Mark Kenyon. That's because I am guest hosting this week, and my name is Tony Peterson. I also do the Wired to Hunt Foundations podcast, if you want to check that out. But Mark is, I believe he said, down at a yo-yo convention in Akron, Ohio this week. So he needed somebody to fill in. He called me up, said, can you do it? I said, I would be happy to, buddy. So I am doing this week's episode, and I am interviewing a guy named Jeremy Moore. Jeremy's been on here a few times. Mark's interviewed him. I've interviewed him on my podcast. He's a really knowledgeable dog trainer who also happens to be a really passionate bow hunter. And so Jeremy trains shed dogs, game recovery dogs, and he bow hunts all fall. And I wanted to have him on because I have a little puppy at home that I'm going to train to hopefully find wounded deer for my family, my friends, anybody who needs it. Because now more and more states are opening up the legal option to go find, you know, recover deer with blood trailing dogs, or I should say game recovery dogs. You'll hear why we shouldn't say the blood tracking thing during this episode. But Jeremy's such a good source of information. He knows so much about this. He knows how to train them. He knows how to tie in all of these different aspects of deer hunting and the relationship, or at least the parallels between sporting dogs and deer. So we go down a couple rabbit holes on this one, but it's a lot of fun. So I think you're really going to enjoy it. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well. How are you doing?
It's good, man. It seems like every podcast I get to host, I get to see your face. So I'm loving the podcast game.
Yeah, and congratulations, too. It's exciting to see you and these guys working together. So I'm looking forward to it.
It's fun. You know, other than having to work with Mark and Spencer, it's a blast. So
yeah, well, I'm not going to say that. I've always had a nice relationship. Everything's went very well with me and Mark, so I've always enjoyed them.
No, they're great. When Mark said, I need some help with a couple of these episodes, I just thought, I'm like, I gotta see if Jeremy wants to do this, because you're tied into these two worlds that I love personally, which is sporting dogs. And, you know, you're a hardcore whitetail bow hunter. You get your family out there. You hunt a lot of deer, and you've kind of mixed these worlds better than just about anyone out there. And you do the shed dog thing, the game recovery thing, and you're a bow hunter. And I'm like, I want to talk to Jeremy because I have a 9-week-old puppy at home who I fully intend to train to find all the deer that we do not hit well.
Sure.
And so I wanted to ask you about that. There's a lot of places I want to go in this podcast, but let's start with that, because this dog of mine, and you know me, this dog's a bird dog first, right? Yep. It's a family dog. Yep. It's a bird dog. I've done the shed antler thing, but I've never done the game recovery thing. What should I be doing?
Well, I think, you know, I you're right. Like, for us, out of necessity, I love working with the dogs so much, but you're right. I do so much deer hunting stuff, and deer hunting is really like if I had to pick one thing to do, I'm not going to give up deer hunting. So by me figuring out ways to include the dogs, that's been a real benefit. But I think that the dogs enhance it. Like, the dogs make it better. You know, when you start talking about tracking dogs, game recovery dogs, there's a clear, it's not hard to understand how they can improve our experience. And, finding one deer that otherwise would not have been found is worth everything that you're going to put into it from a work standpoint, training standpoint. That satisfaction is, you know, it's hard to beat. It's so much that I know, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit, but like, some guys are really hardcore into tracking, and almost all of them that I know at one time were very avid hunters, and then they started tracking with their dogs, and this was so much more enjoyable to them. They enjoyed that, they got a bigger rush out of it. They, everything that was more desirable for them to do the dog stuff that they end up, they don't hunt, because there is a fine line and balance of time and everything. When people really get into it, obviously takes a lot of time, and the time of year for a tracking dog, it's hard to hunt because there's a relatively short window of time that that's when the tracking dogs are needed. So, but yeah, I, with you, with a young dog, what do you need to get started? And you had sent me a message earlier, by the way. You'll see an email come through shortly, but I sent you a message with some questions that you had sent me for something, another project you're working on, and kind of a similar question, you know, what are you gonna get started with a pup? And I hate to be that guy that's beating the dead horse over and over and over, but I always say when it comes to dogs, regardless of what we're doing with them, the foundation has to be there first. So I don't care if it's tracking dog, bird dog, shed dog, name it whatever you want to do with it in the field. Without a foundation, and when I say foundation, I mean obedience, like heel, sit, stay, come when I call you. Those are the big four. If you don't have that, first off, you won't enjoy the dog, whether it's in the field or not. And second off, you can't really do this training that I think is necessary to develop those skills without those foundational things, because it's like a basketball team can't play a game if they don't know how to dribble and they can't, if they don't know how to shoot. So there's these real basic things that, and that all has to be there first. So the foundation. And I spend literally months and months and months on it. At the same time, I do think there's little things that you can start doing with that pup. How old's your pup right now?
So she's 9 weeks and we're doing, I mean, she's already sit down, place, come. I'm working on heel with her. So I'm working on, you know, it's all treat training stuff, but working on all that. I just didn't know if there was anything, any little things on this blood tracking side of things that I should start thinking about for the near future.
Well, yeah, you can. And it's just, the thing is you don't have to, but you certainly can. And I think what the slippery slope is when we start giving a list of here's what you should do type stuff, everybody takes it so literally that they focus on that. And what I emphasize with young dogs is let them develop as they develop. Like we can help them along the way, but I don't think we should be steering them too hard when they're little, because I think that the thing that'll make a lot of people maybe relax a little bit about the idea of developing dogs for the field is that the hard work has been done by people for hundreds of years before us. So we don't have to worry about like fitting the round peg into the square hole. Like these dogs, and it doesn't matter what breed, like we'll probably talk some breed stuff too, but these dogs have the ability to find game in them. And we don't have to put it in. So we don't train them to track. It's just like I don't train retrievers to retrieve, and we don't train pointing dogs to point. Like they have it in them, but not all of them come out at the same time either. So yes, there's stuff I want to like expose it to give it an opportunity to develop, maybe come out a little quicker. You know, you brought up treat training, and I not to go off on a tangent, but like, treat training to me makes trainers feel really good. I don't treat train, and I'm not against treat training. I also don't use shock collars, and I'm not against shock collars. I just don't use them, and I don't use them because I don't feel like I need them, and I don't think they help me. And I think they put me in a lot of people in situations that aren't the best for themselves and the dogs. The idea of treat training, I think, is really a accelerated way of getting little dogs to shape into things behavior wise that we like to see. I'm not against that. Like I don't have a problem with it. I look at it and I go, I like to shape dogs into desirable behaviors as well. But I feel like that happens. If you're consistent and you lead them down a good path, it will happen. What I don't like is trying to speed stuff up to get ahead, because I just don't think you get ahead with dogs. I think you get ahead and then you find yourself in a bad position. And I think that a lot of times the treat training, I've seen some incredible treat training videos where people are having these 9-week-old puppies like yours healing off lead. And I go, everybody goes, man, they taught that dog to heel off lead already. And I said, yeah, but no, they're not heeling them off lead. They're guiding them with a piece of kibble in their hand. And that kind of, but what I look at it is at the end, when you take the kibble, if you took the kibble away, does the behavior stay? And I don't think it does as well. I like to look at it as I take a different approach to shaping. It takes a little more time, admittedly, but I don't care what the score is at the end of the first quarter. It's the end of the game that matters. So like to be 6 weeks ahead of where I am today looks good, but let's talk in 6 months or 6 years and see how did things go along that time frame? Because it's in the end that really matters. So when it comes to these little dogs, kibble is great. I like food, especially with food-driven dogs. So for tracking or for birds or for sheds or for anything that uses nose work, I like to use food. I think you can use it to your advantage. And so I would take, grass, go outside and get your front lawn and cut a circle. Maybe you'll do it in the backyard, but mow it so that there's a little bit taller grass in a relatively small area, and take that bowl of food that you normally were going to feed that pup. By 9 weeks you're on solid. Like I've got puppies in the back right now. They're 4 weeks. They got their first solid meal today. It's mush. It's not hard kibble, but eventually within a couple of weeks, they're going to be eating dry kibble. And so you could take that kibble and you could put it in the grass. So you mowed a circle. Let's say you mowed a circle about 6 or 7 feet in diameter. Not real big, but for that dog, it's pretty good sized distance. And the height doesn't have to be real tall grass. It just needs to be, 2 or 3 inches taller than everything around it. And so it's a clear like island of taller grass, and sprinkle some food in there, kibble, a handful of it, and then take the dog and let it go downwind. And then I don't have to say anything. Just be downwind of it and watch that puppy use its nose and work into that cover, and then watch its body language. So watch its tail, watch how it breathes. It goes from maybe panting through its mouth to all of a sudden its mouth is closed, and you start to hear that little Hoover vacuum. And now all of a sudden they're working that nose, and that tail starts to change the cadence. And I like using that to A, get the puppy to understand, if I use my nose, there's really good things that happen. It's the exact same thing that happened the day the puppy was born. When I watch these pups behind me that are 4 weeks old right now, when they were born, within 4 or 5 hours, they were literally scooching themselves across the whelping pen to get over by mom if she had adjusted. They can't see and they can't hear, but they can smell. And so they literally made their way across this gigantic whelping box to them and got there. And why did they get there? Because they were hungry and they wanted to get warm, and they curled up by mom and they nursed. So they've been doing it since literally the first hours they were alive. Now we're just like adding distractions. We're adding some things. Their dogs have become mobile. So now they can run around a little bit, cover some ground. But those are things that I think you can do that enhance that dog's understanding of use my nose, get some reward. But I think also you're going to start to feel just as good about watching your dog do that. I think a lot of this early stuff on is like keeping us excited about it and making us feel good. You'll be able to start reading the dog's body language and going, man, my dog really says a lot by just physically making changes with its body and how it works. So you could configure different, I use that. I call that a hunt command. So like I put that food in there and I let them find it. And in the background, a lot of times with my dogs, I give them a verbal cue. You can say lost, you can say find it, you can say whatever you want to say. But I stand in the back after the first day or two and I start to read that language, just watching them do what they do naturally. And then I start layering in some verbal over the top of it. So you can start find it, find it, find it, find it, find it. And that doesn't mean anything to them at that point, but they hear it because they can hear. And you're in the background just saying it over and over and over again. And every time you say it, they're in that area. They're in that tall grass. Their noses are working, their tails are going, and they're getting rewards. And that reward is that kibble. And so you do that enough, and it's classic conditioning. It's Pavlov. So you do it enough, and all of a sudden I can sit here in the living room, and I've got a couple of dogs laying on the beds right now. And if I go find it, find it, find it, find it, I'll look in their noses, even in their sleep. their noses will start to move. Their noses will start to get driplets of water on it because they hear that and their body tells them, I have to use my nose and something good will come from it. So,
so hold on a second. Is that find it command, or is that like a generic thing? Like fetch would be for some people, or are you tying that specifically to later blood trailing efforts?
So this is early on just to develop what I call hunt command. I wouldn't use find it the whole time while we're tracking, because it's too much verbal and there's really no reason. Yep. So what I would do is I might use find it to start. Like I might use find it to engage the dog in the idea of there's something here for me to find. And then as soon as they're on it, I shut up. Like I think one of the biggest things that we do, and I'm guilty of it, and I can be accused of very easily, and I will agree with it, is, well, you talk an awful lot when you're training. On video, yes. But I'm not talking to the dog, I'm talking to the camera. And so I make a point of, like, our YouTube channel is filled with all sorts of different videos. And I oftentimes remind people of, hey, I am going to talk. It's going to actually make my training a lot harder, and we're going to get a lot less done than I think we could if we weren't so verbal, because I think it becomes white noise to the dog. So when I actually do have to give them something verbally, it doesn't have the impact because I'm so constantly talking. So that's a give and take where I could go and just film it, and you could, and the guys could follow me around with the camera and I could say nothing. And then the viewer would have to guess. They're like, I wonder why he did that. I don't think that that's as valuable for YouTube as it is for me with a session with the dog. So they look a little bit different. I had a guy that we had a workshop this weekend, and we had people from all across the country here. And one of the biggest things that stood out to me, one guy, he had a little German short-haired pointer. I encourage people to be encouraging to their dogs. I think we get in a rut. This is a general dog training thing, but I think we get in a rut where we pick apart all the bad things. We correct, we get really good at correcting. And that's fine. You need to correct things. It's pressure and praise. I think that's how they learn. But you have to be really good at the corrections, sharp timing. You have to acknowledge and have reflexes. Well, this guy, most people are really good at the corrections. They're not so good at reminding the dog when they do it well. So I always am talking to people and saying, how many goods did you say there? How many times did you tell the dog good? Because you corrected it 4 times, but 10 times it was in perfect position and I didn't hear anything. Oh yeah, yeah. So I got to remember to say good. Well, this guy, he just talked and talked and talked constantly. He talked good, 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 constantly. And he never left any silence. And I told him, I said, man, I love your enthusiasm. But you're the opposite of everybody else. You need to just throttle back and save it for when it really matters. Because when you really need to give, and his dog was really little. He had like a 12-week-old pup. So I said, when your dog really does something well, you need that dog to understand it. And if you're constantly talking to it, and then the verbal is the way you praise it, they're not going to know the difference between that and the rest of the jibber jabber that they hear from you. So you have to balance that a little bit. But when we're tracking, I shut up. Mm-hmm. I don't say anything. My job is to focus on that dog and understand, based on its body language, how are we doing? And, you know, if the dog gets off and you can tell that the dog is off of the line, I might help the dog, because this isn't a test. This is a training thing. We're working together. I might help the dog by re-engaging them with that find it command. Find it, good, good, and then shut up. And when I say good, envision that dog going, change in body language. Oh, got the scent. Now I'm quiet, and I let the dog work.
Yeah, is this, are you seeing more interest here now? You know, I mean, people who know the history of the European game recovery dogs, I mean, that's like, just ensconced in that dog culture over there. Like there's no, you know, we think about dogs in different categories, like house dogs and, you know, hunting dogs and this kind of new category of game recovery dogs. But really over there, they don't differentiate. And now more and more states are legalizing, you know, blood trailing on a leash or off leash or 30-foot check cord or whatever. Are you seeing more interest come up with that? Or are you having more just like general sporting dog owners that are interested in it?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's great that they are, because I think it saves more game. I think more game gets found now than it ever has before because of the dogs. And that really is 100% the reasoning and the objective is find game that otherwise won't be found. And, but when I think about that question, I think yes, when it comes to big game, but I will remind, like, there's a lot of people that are intimidated by the idea of, you know, dabbling in tracking or, you know, big game recovery with a dog, any dog. I don't care the breed. I don't care if it's a crossover, like you're going to do multiple things with the dog. But I want to remind anyone who's got that doubt in their mind or that second guessing, game recovery, yeah, you're right. The Europeans look at it completely different than we do over here, but not really, because we all understand over here in the States, we all understand the value of a dog to recover game. It's just not big game. Yeah. Like a pheasant dog has the most value a pheasant dog brings to me is get cripples. Like if I wing a bird and it sails and it hits the ground and it's running, I will never get it by myself. And very rarely are you going to be able to catch back up to it, not in cover, and be able to find it and get the game, recover it. Where that's what the dog does. The greatest retrieve of my memory with any dog in my whole life was my first Labrador retriever. And it was a duck that we shot and it sailed way. It was in the Dakotas. It sailed way across this pothole. We were hunting over water. It hit the water. It swam to the shore. It went up. We saw it cross a road. And we're like, I mean, it was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards away. And we're like, there's no way. We're never going to find that duck. So we got done. We picked up. And I said, I'm just going to take Remy over there. And we walked way over there. She got on that line. This is hours later. And she went up and she crossed that road. And we literally just sat there and waited so long that the trucks came around and we're sitting there. We watched her work a chiseled plow field. She went into a CRP. And all of a sudden she came back long time later. I mean, 10, 15 minutes later with a live Drake mallard in her mouth. And she brought it back to us. And so I look at that and I go, that's a tracking job. That's all that was a tracking job. And so there's not a lot of difference between tracking a bird or tracking a rabbit or tracking a deer. It's just our perception of it as hunters over here is, oh, that's so much different. It's not.
Yeah.
You know, look at hounds. Look at how we hunt with hounds over here.
It's more of a, it's a skill. You kind of alluded to this earlier that they have, and this is sort of a bolt on task. Like this is, you know, for a while there, and you saw this, people were getting like dedicated shed dogs, you know, or dedicate, yep. You know, and the guys you're talking about who are just blood tracking now, they're not hunting anymore. That's just their thing. They're looking for a specific kind of dog, but this is something that you can take, you know, all kinds of different working dogs out there, probably dogs that we don't even think of as working dogs. And they have thousands and thousands of years of evolution of this. This is already built into them. We just need to give them the opportunity to develop it a little bit and have that framework of control around it, like you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I think when you think about like the original tracking dogs, the best tracking dogs, you think of like the ones that depend on it to survive. Wolves, coyotes, like they're really good tracking dogs, and they become it because if they aren't, they'll die. Like they don't survive. And you know the idea and the understanding. Like I truly believe that one of the biggest values a tracking dog brings to me is a much clearer understanding of what actually happened when it comes to, let's say a scenario is somebody hits a deer, archery is the biggest one that I see, but let's say it's archery hunt. Somebody hits the deer, knew they hit it well. They always know they hit it well. And then you go to the scene. Well, you start to look at it. I've seen it so many times. Now this is only after a lot of experience. But with dogs, like an experienced dog, I can't tell you how many countless times that I've seen these really well-trained dogs that have seen and been on lots of tracks, literally within 100 yards of it, I can look and I don't think this deer is dead. And it's always discouraging to the hunter. And they're always, no. You know, they know. Well, how many times, I can't tell you how many times that the hunter knew where the deer went. And the dog said it went somewhere else. And no, it's this way. The dog says it's this way. No, it's this way. Dog says that all of a sudden, here's the deer. How did it get over there? Well, I don't know how. And I'm not saying that the people are lying about it. I don't think it's intentional. But a lot of things happen in the woods, and you get confused, and you get excited, and you see something that you thought you saw. And the dogs are the honest part in this puzzle. You know, like they really tell us the truth all the time. And you know, I've been on tracks where I know it's very, very unlikely that we're going to recover this deer. And they can tell us that pretty quickly. And I think it's because, and it's through body language, but I think that it has a lot to do with the idea of when you think back to, like, as these animals evolve, if they're bad trackers, as far as they track and they're not tracking a deer that's going to eventually expire or is hurt so bad that they could catch up to it. If they just chase the, you know, chase to chase, they burn more calories than they ever take in. And if you do that, you don't make it. So they're just, the depth of them is amazing. And that all takes a lot of, you know, that takes a lot of experience for the dog. It takes a lot of experience for the handler to be able to read the dog, and the other sign. Like, I think great trackers, like tracking dogs, really good tracking dogs, are not just independent units. They're always teamed up with a really good tracker. Trackers and tracking dogs, it's not coincidental that they're always together. There's a lot of input from the handler, and there's a lot of understanding that you got to trust the dog at times. And it's very much a team. And the more they do, the better they get. It's just like anything else. But I also think, you know, so I say all that stuff and I go, and I know that will intimidate people and go, well, I can't do that. I'm not that guy. One of the first stories I heard about tracking success was I was in college and a roommate of mine had a golden retriever that his buddy shot a deer and they couldn't find it. My buddy took his dog with to go look for it. They weren't taking it to track and no training. I mean, zero training. And they brought the dog with and they went to look for where the deer was and the dog ran off. Like, I mean, with conviction, like he looked like he was going there somewhere for a reason. And so my buddy followed his dog and the guy that shot the deer kept looking for some type of sign, some type of visual clue. And it didn't go very far. And here he follows this dog and here the dog is right next to that dead deer. And so he's like, I couldn't believe it. But so no training, no experience, no extra effort put in. And that dog did it like an old pro. So I don't share that story with everyone to be like, don't work at it. Just take your dog. It'll happen. But I also think it's for most of us, we're somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Well, that's just an example. You know, we should comment on this or talk about this a little bit, but you know, we say blood tracking dogs, but they're following the scent of a wounded animal. Like there's a lot more to it than that. And so people kind of think like, oh, they're finding a spot of blood and then they're sniffing for the next one. That's not how it works. They're, you know, when you think about, you talk about that rooster you knock down that goes running or that might be the best scenario because you think about being in a place with tons of pheasant sign, you knock a rooster down, that dog knows which scent to follow to track that sucker down. And it's not because he's blood trailing a rooster going 400 miles an hour. You know, I mean, they know the smell of a, so this is like inherent in them. And so it's about us just giving them those opportunities and then having the ability to reset them and control them in these situations until they just go, oh, this is what I'm doing. Like, okay, I can do this.
Yeah, for sure. The you know, you're right. The blood tracking part of it, I for a long time I got away from saying blood tracking because I was trying to make a point of like they're not tracking blood. Yep. Like if there was blood, we wouldn't need them. It's the idea that there isn't blood, and there's it's usually not that there isn't any blood because oftentimes there is some type of a clue, but there's so much more than just blood. And yes, it's specific to following, you know, I think one of the biggest asked questions, the biggest fear that people have is if I train my dog to track deer, they'll run deer. And it couldn't be further from the truth. The idea of a dog that runs deer. Now, will dogs run deer? For sure. Untrained dogs run deer. Like, it's a I always say to people, like, if your pheasant dog jumps a deer while you're pheasant hunting and chases it, do you have a bad pheasant dog? No, you don't have a problem with it. It's not a pheasant problem. It's a control problem with a pheasant dog. So if the dog is chasing deer, it's an issue with control. And so tracking dogs don't just follow deer. They follow a specific deer. And that's made up of all sorts of different clues. There's a ton of it. There's adrenaline that comes off of a wounded deer that has a very, I take my dog to the vet, and I black Labrador, so bring them to the vet, and I get there and I'm always embarrassed because God, they do not take care of these dogs. They got all this dandruff, like they flake. I get them up on the table, they get inspected, and black dog with all this white dander. And I go, geez, man, he's never like that at home. He's got a nice coat, I thought. And the vet says, no, he's nervous. What do you mean he's nervous? Oh, he's nervous. So when he's nervous, he exfoliates. And so when you exfoliate, skin cells come off, dander comes off. Well, I learned from a canine trainer that I probably picked up more like understanding of how dogs process scent than anyone else. And he was in New York City. I met him at ATA show, archery trade show. But so we were talking, and he was training dogs to track criminals or people, individual people through the streets of New York. And where he's explaining to me this process, and he goes, "Yeah, a criminal has an adrenaline rush when they're being chased. You ever get afraid of something and run? Like, it's a weird feeling that overcomes your entire body, and that creates scent. When you're nervous, you start to exfoliate. Dander happens. Well, that's scent. Those are all scent clues, and that you're leaving this mist down the road and through the building and wherever you're going." Which are settling down, and then the dog utilizes that as a scent clue. So you step in something, and then you run for a distance. You're going to carry that scent. That's a scent clue for that dog, and it's associated with a specific person, not just people. So a deer is the same way. A deer has an interdigital gland in between their hoof. It's unique to them. It's a lot. It literally is like a fingerprint, and so that has a unique scent, and that specific interdigital gland. Combined with all these other scent clues, that dog puts all that in its memory and goes, if I smell one of these 500 different scent clues, it's this deer. And, oh, I crossed another deer, but that does not have this one. And it needs to have this in order for it to be that. So I have to follow. So I leave that one alone and I follow this one. And the thing is as we talk about it, we're kind of like, I'm trying to like draw this picture of how this dog is processing it. Well, it happened like that. Like, I mean, it's the fastest computer in the world.
Yeah,
is the way their nose works. So really amazing.
Yeah, it is. I interviewed a canine researcher from Texas Tech one time for Sporting Dog Talk. And he focuses on their olfactory abilities, and he's studying how good are their noses really. And he described it to me as them being able to smell three drops of something in an Olympic size pool.
Yeah.
That's how, and I always think about this with deer when people are like, oh, I put on this suit and I beat the deer's nose. And I'm like, I can't remember. I think a dog is like 320 million scent receptors and a deer is 370 or something. It's wild, wild numbers. And then you think about how they can key in on those biochemical little clues on somebody running through New York, or, that deer that has a certain kind of wound or something like that. And they can follow that through a billion different other scents, and they can filter that through while running. It's like amazing. I mean, it's so incredible that they can do that.
It's hard to, and it is hard to wrap your mind around it. I think sometimes the belief comes in witnessing it, like you watch, there's all these examples, but like there's at the border that I've heard about, that where this drug dog picked up dope that was coming through, and it was encased in concrete. Like it was drugs inside of a concrete pillar, and the dog was able to pick that up. So when you hear, if that's the case, we're not fooling these dogs' noses with our, we're not, I don't have to be too worried about like, a big one for shed hunting is wear rubber gloves. And I laugh at it and I go, are you kidding me? that's the thing you think is holding your dog up in training because you're not wearing a pair of rubber gloves. Like, it's insulting to the dogs. So their noses are just, I don't think we will understand exactly how to be able to put it into measure. But I mean, when you bring up deer stuff and scent suits and all that stuff, here's one that I did give a bit of credibility to is I read a article about, they had a drug dog or a canine unit dog. It was I think it was a man tracker, but they had a test where they had, I think it was 9 boxes in a room, box big enough to cover up a person. And they put people in the box and they let the dog in the room and the dog has to find the box that the person is in and indicate. So they did it with nothing, like just put a person in the room and it happened in a matter of like less than a few seconds. Dog went right to the box, boom, got it. So they put the dog, they sprayed the person down with like a scent killer type thing and dog went right to the box. You know, it maybe was like a split second longer, but it went right to the box. They put a carbon suit on the person or some type of one of those suits and just a hint more, just yep. a touch more, longer to find. And then they put an ozone unit in.
Yep.
And when they put the ozone unit in, it took about 4 or 5 times as long for the dog. It was like 15 to 20 seconds versus 3 to 5. And the dog went to it and found him. But it took a while.
Yeah.
And I thought, and so a lot of people will read that and go, yeah, it doesn't work. The dog found him. Of course they found him. It's not, the dog is, well, it's not going to fool them.
In that test, they shut the ozone unit off too. So when I've messed around with trying to fool dogs a million different ways. That was a Field and Stream test they did. Yeah. And if you know about ozone, like, it's a bleaching agent. It's an unstable molecule that binds to biological molecules. And it was the only thing I found when I was training Luna, my older lab now, for shed antlers, where I could treat an antler and treat my gloves. And then I could throw that antler out there and leave it. And I could see that dog would run downwind of it, and not pick it up right away. I tried spraying it down every other way. Cause you know how it is. Like, if you handle it with your hand, they're going to smell, there's all kinds of scent on it. Right. Sure. So you throw that antler out, they get downwind of it in the grass. They know, they're just on it, turn on a dime. And I thought, is there, you know, there has to be a way to try to do this where I'm not introducing all these extra smells and this hand smell. The only thing I found that worked was ozone.
Sure. And I, with that study, I look at it and I go, for a deer hunter, like, if it gives me a couple extra seconds, if it gives me 15 seconds versus 3, there's value there. Cause if it's the right deer, I can kill them, yeah. You know? And so I think that understanding the power of that nose, it's hard for us probably to wrap our mind around, but we get off in these directional talking about this, but what it comes down to is, think about it. A gut shot deer runs through the woods. Like, is that challenging for our dog? Probably not. It's not so much the tracking itself of the deer. I think what really creates the biggest issues are scent conditions. And I think it's overlooked because the easiest track job in the world is very challenging if the dog's not capable of processing the scent because of outside influence, which can be temperature, can be barometric pressure, it can be moisture, it can be the heat, but not so much the heat on the scent, but how it affects the dog and how it affects the dog's ability to breathe, because the dog has to breathe through its nose in order to process scent. So we worked this weekend at this workshop and it was terribly warm. I mean, it was 90 in the 90s, and we did a hunt command drill. And I said, you know, we got to be realistic with these dogs, not only because from a safety factor, but also from a, like, let's recognize some of the things we do are going to be maybe not that challenging on a normal day. They're extremely challenging today, because not only are we asking the dog to process scent with its nose and find stuff, we're asking them to be comfortable in 95 degree weather in the sun when it's June and they're probably not in their best shape of the year. And so if you're having a hard time, and I think it's a real good thing to put yourself in the dog's shoes occasionally. Cause I said to a few people, you know, that get frustrated. I've said this over the years, when people get frustrated with their dogs not doing well in tough conditions, I tell them, well, why don't you run a couple laps down and back? And then I'm going to see if you can talk, carry on a good conversation with me, because they can't even say their name because they're just huffing and puffing. I say, now you know what it feels like to be your dog, to have to go try to do something that completely relies on using your nose when you're having a hard time catching your breath to begin with. So I think we have to keep all that stuff in the back of our minds.
Well, yeah. And you have to look at this when you get certain challenging conditions, like the extreme heat that we've had lately. A lot of times you don't get any wind either. Right. You know, you get those just dead days. And, you know, Mark and I just did some stuff on this as far as like deer studies with, you know, a lot of hunters think that the deer movement, you know, really, really falls off the cliff when the wind's blowing hard. And they've studied that, and it's just not true. It's the opposite, you know. And the worst times to hunt for buck movement are when there's no wind whatsoever. And if you like, it's making a leap, but I don't think it's a big one to say it's probably because you're taking their nose out of the game, and they don't like that.
Yeah, sure, know? Sure.
And so, yep. I mean, it's so much of that stuff. I think, you know, this is why I wanted to have you on here. I think it's so cool how much dogs can teach you about deer, you know, even if you have to make those little leaps. It's just like there's so many things that are similar about them.
Yeah. And when you start thinking about, you know, the beauty of the dog for tracking purposes is there's a lot of levels to it. One of them is a completeness to it. Like if you wound a deer, first off, all deer don't die when you shoot them. I mean, I think some people have a hard time believing that, you know, they don't, they're the toughest damn animals out. I mean, they're just so, their will to live and they're just sheer toughness is hard to wrap around our little brains. And, you know, I think it's funny when you think about, like, God, some of the injuries I see bucks come out of during the rut. And I go, if that happened to me, I'd lay down and hope and wish I died, you know, like, I don't know that I, and then you think now, then they're going to go run up and down hills and continue to chase and not eat. The stuff that their bodies are capable of doing is really remarkable. And we have to understand that just because we put a hit on the deer, there are percentage chances that it's not dead. It's not going to be a mortal wound. Yeah. And so the best tracking dog in the world won't find a deer that doesn't die. And we have to accept that, which sometimes is a struggle. But the beauty of the tracking dog is, for me, it's a peace of mind. It's an understanding that, look, I probably did. If you brought in a tracking dog from somewhere else, or you used your own tracking dog, I think there's a sense of comfort in knowing, I think you did just about everything you could from a moral standpoint, from an ethical standpoint, to recover that animal. And I know how deer hunters are. I'm like that. I've lost sleep at night. I've lost sleep at night with deer that I haven't shot at, much less those that I have shot. And I've lost deer over the years. And if you haven't, God bless you. Don't criticize those who have. And I think that's easy for us to do in it. And I think, you hunt long enough, you go through it. It's the hardest part. It's one of the hardest parts of being a hunter. But it happens. And the dog allowing me to understand, A, I don't think it's dead. B, if it is, I did everything I could to try to find it. And there is a sense, I think, of satisfaction when it comes to that.
Yeah. Well, you bring up a good point there that I think you can't talk about enough, which when it comes to deer hunting and specifically shooting deer, like the thing that's most dangerous is what you think you know. Like, I know I hit him right here. Ask any guide out there, right? Like, I hit him right behind the shoulder, perfect shot. And then all of a sudden you can't find him. And it's like, it didn't work that way. And that's why those situations when you're like, man, I know that I saw the arrow hit here and he reacted this way. When you find him and get to actually see what happened. Or like you said, you get that dog on that track and that dog's just not interested. And it's a seasoned 7-year-old dog. It's done, been there, done that. You go, okay, something different happened. That is kind of one of those weird experiential things that over time makes you a way better hunter, because you just realize, like, man, I get this stuff wrong a lot.
For sure. And accepting it, realizing that and being okay with that, that's a big step. And it's a life step, you know, accepting the fact that you're not always right and being okay with it and learning from it is real important. The biggest, I think one of the, a tracking dog and a tracker's best friend is a trail camera, because the deer that you know are dead, when they show back up late season, when they show back up next year, when they show back up, you know, somewhere down the road, and you go, oh my God, that deer's still alive. Ask any, you know, serious tracker that tracks for other people. Like, I don't go on tracks. I'm not a tracker. I don't go on tracks for other people because I literally don't have time to do it. I track for myself. I track for my family, close friends, just because of available time. But I have a lot of friends that are, you know, really serious trackers, and even when their dog tells them it's not dead, there is always that, you know, oh man, I just, you know, I don't want to disappoint. You don't want to be disappointing to people. And when you go and you look, you don't find it, to get that email, to get a text message with the picture, you know, that's a real comforting feeling. It's a real reassuring feeling. It's a confidence builder for you and your dog. Occasionally you're going to get that picture that says, you know, we found it. And that's okay too, because at that point, the biggest question, well, where was it? And what was the hit? And you start to look at it, because, you know, a lot of times what ends up happening is, and I'm not a numbers guy, I could care less about recovery percentages. And there are some statisticians out there that, you know, they're trackers or they're shed hunters or they're whatever, and they measure everything by numbers. And I don't like that. I'm not really interested in stats, but the idea of successful recoveries, you know, sometimes we find out that, you know, we couldn't find it. And so now I gotta have a track that has no recovery. And the deer might be dead. The deer might die anyway. But what ends up happening is deer goes off the property that you have the ability to look for, and crosses a fence, and you can't go over there, and you can't get permission. And that, a lot of times that's how it happens, you know? And so all these things can come up, and it's a shame, but it's reality. And it's the part that, you know, without the dog, I feel like we haven't given it everything we need to give it to, you know, with the effort, from an effort standpoint. So
yeah,
it's the reality.
Yeah. And I mean, it's important to say too, that, you know, they're not foolproof either. I mean, there are situations with a dog, like you said, with the conditions or just some anomalies that show up. I mean, I talked to you about this, but my daughter shot a doe in northern Wisconsin last year with a crossbow, and it was keyed up, you know, those things are loud. It was a weird deal. And it looked to me like a good hit, but it was fast. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So I was like, I don't know. And, you know, if they don't go down in sight, then I'm like, okay, well, sure. Now we don't know. And we ended up having some rain come in that night, and we had a giant bear. And I know this because I saw the deer spook, and then I checked a trail camera, and we had a bear get on that trail. And so the next day I found a blood tracking guy to come in, and he had Drahars, and he came in and couldn't find it and couldn't get on it and never really get the dog excited about it. And it was one of those things that I don't know if that was because that deer made it and it was just not that great of a hit. I really don't know. Or something with that bear screwed it up or bumped it in a weird way. It's just, it was like a good reminder that you think, okay, well, this is going to be the ticket. And like, it's way better than not doing that, but it's not a guarantee.
Yeah. I mean, dogs have bad days too. You know, like I've worked in this is something that as a trainer, you'll get it too. And the more you do it, the more you'll understand it, because you'll see it. But you know, I've, there have been times where I go, there's no reason why my dog couldn't find that, that I just can't figure out why. And I don't know what it is. I don't know if, I mean, maybe they have a headache. Maybe they're dehydrated. Maybe there's something that's going on inside their body that is, they're struggling, but they're probably way more consistent than I am when it comes to that kind of stuff. But there are things that happen that we don't recognize or realize when scenting conditions. That's why I say some of the biggest overlooked things are the conditions, I think. You know, there are dogs that will find, that will track no problem 48 hours later, 72 hours later. They'll get on a track and go, and they'll nail it. And then there are dogs you can put on 12 hours later that struggle to get on the track. And it that's a clear indicator of like the conditions. That 72 hour day was perfect, and it made, everything was in place. And you know, the 12 hour one might have been the toughest, hardest conditions, and it just doesn't matter. If you can't smell it, you can't smell it. Yep. And that it can create those conditions can create more issues for a dog than anything. You know, and the reality is too, when you start tracking these deer, we screw it up ourselves for trackers more often than not by tracking too quickly. And I think that's natural. You know, like when I was growing up without even thinking about using dogs, my family's, and it comes from my grandpa and my dad, and we thought you just get after it, get after that deer and go. Well, a lot of times I think that gut shot deer are going to die. They're going to die, but it could take them a long time. Like it could take a day or two. And so if they're not pushed, they're not in a hurry to go for a run. Like they're going to hunker down. Every time you bump a deer, your chances of recovering them are that much less, because you just put a whole nother boost of energy into that deer. You just put a whole nother shot of adrenaline into them. You just put all these, now all of a sudden that deer pushes a little bit further and he crosses some type of a barrier that makes it that much more challenging. Where if we had just, it's really tough, but the hard part is sometimes deciding to say, let's not go after it yet. Let's wait. And that at times is more often, it's the way to do it. You know, when in doubt, back out is that saying. And I think there's a lot to it, whether you're a dog or whether you're going with a dog or not. The other thing is hell, half the people that call for a dog call after they can't find it. And they brought every guy in camp and grid searched every property that they had and every neighboring property. And then you bring a dog in and you say, here, sort that out. And that's really challenging. And yeah. I don't know if that's fair to say that, you know, it's mistakes that we make. And then we like to, well, that dog's no good. Well, no, it's not that. It's, we didn't handle it properly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see that with dogs. You see the people who know dogs really well, giving the dogs every chance to do what they do without interfering. Like you said, without yelling, without moving too fast, with you know, respect to the wind and how that's working and the conditions and everything. There's a lot that's going on there. Let's switch gears a second here. I want to talk to you about something else. You know, I know you're big into the shed dog world. That's been covered a lot. That I was thinking about this and how to like tie dogs into the whitetail world. And man, one of the things that my dogs teach me, and you know, doing this job, like you're pretty tied up in a tree stand until at least for me, mid November. And then I switch over and I do a lot of late season grouse and a lot of late season pheasant hunting. And I'll tell you what, those dogs take me into places where pheasants live right after the gun season ends here in Minnesota. Yep. And the amount of freaking deer that we jump in those places that sit so tight is incredible. Like really quality bucks on public land in the immediate days after gun season. And it's always such an aha moment to me when that happens.
Yeah. And I think, you can that for sure, but also when it comes to tracking, like tracking dogs give you a real education, because when you don't know where the deer went and you're following it with a dog and there's no visual sign, but you're getting some confirmation where you're finding a wound bed or you're finding a little bit of some hair, or you're finding some type of sign to confirm you're on the right track, you start to learn really quickly that deer do some pretty patternable things when they're wounded. And like deer will go to certain areas, and you know, everybody knows they go to water, you know, wounded deer's gonna go to water. That's true in a lot of scenarios, but I've also heard people tell me a mortally wounded deer won't go uphill. Well, I hunt in the bluff country, and I've tracked a hell of a lot of deer up to the top of the hill and found them dead.
Yep.
So if we, with, you know, following a dog. So if we don't, I think the one thing about deer is we'll never know everything about them, and they'll never cease to amaze us or surprise us. And so, you know, I shed hunted quite a bit this spring, and shed hunting led me into areas that I thought were great grouse covers, because I love grouse hunting. And I'm like, oh God, I'm in these popple slashings, and I'm going, man, this is good grouse cover. And I realized I wasn't flushing any grouse in there when I was shed hunting. I was flushing the grouse up on the edges and the prickly ash on the edges of the fields. For whatever reason, that's where they were, they were drumming in there. And I think that prickly ash serves as kind of like a shield from birds of prey. So I was like, God, this is kind of interesting. Well, then I go out on that point and I find this little isolated bed on the end of the point. And there's a shed from 5-6 years ago that's green and laying underneath a log. And I'm like, a buck lays here, you know, and this, and then I sit there and I look and I go, look at his view. Look at that northwest wind that's in his face. Look at all these different things that make sense. I probably don't go there ever if I'm not shed hunting with my dog. And so it opened my eyes to it. And then I go down to some of the slashings and I look at, and I go, I literally stood in one spot and counted over 100 rubbed popple slashings. And I went, man, this is like a breeding nest in here. And I think what was happening was it's so thick, you know, how those covers are, there's just such stem density. So I'm going, well, this is great cover. I don't think deer live in it most of the time of the year, but I guarantee you, and I've watched bucks walk out of that stuff and feed while tending a doe and then turn and walk right back into it. And I've watched them from a distance doing that. And I'm going, I don't think for a second that buck doesn't bring that doe into that complete tangled mess, because it helps, I think, him keep other bucks off of her. Like, I think it's like this nest of breeding. And I think all those rubs are completely a sign of his frustration. Like, I guarantee you, he is, and other bucks probably, you know, cruising around this hot doe that's in there, and they're so damn mad at each other and upset, they're just shredding every tree they see. And so I made a mental note of a couple of those spots, and I said, our major corridor is going into this thing and coming out of this thing on both ends. And I don't know that it's not a bad idea for us to have a stand hung on both ends of it. You can't hunt inside of it. You'd never be able to shoot. But if I hunted on both ends of it, there's probably about a 2-week window that I would have value in sitting there and spending all day. Yep. Because it, you know, just the number of, the amount of sign, the volume of sign that was there. But I don't find that if I'm not shed hunting. I don't find that if I'm not with those dogs in there.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, is the, we kind of talk in this, you know, in this whitetail space specifically, we say, you know, oh, go scout this way, get in there, look at this, cover tons of ground. And I always think like, man, how many people are actually doing that without like a little more motivation and taking the dog out? You know, it's kind of like I talk on here all the time about, you know, I go on turkey hunts and I find awesome places to deer hunt. I go pheasant hunting and I get a just master's course on how good bucks are at hiding from us. And when they make the decision that they don't want to get seen, they can do that living in a county with 7 trees and very, very little actual cover, and they can disappear on you and they will sit there. I mean, we have times, so many times every season, where we'll be, you know, looking for a rooster we shot, or just working the dogs, and there'll be a little tiny willow patch or something on the edge of the cattails, and a buck will scare you as he gets up. He's so close. Yeah. And that's a buck. And a lot of times it's behind us already. So that's a buck that's let, you know, 2 or 3 guys go by, 2 dogs go by, and has sat so tight that he's busting out the backside after you've already went through. And I just look at that and I go, man, you think about these big woods bucks that you hunt in northern Wisconsin or somewhere else, or you're down in Louisiana in the swamps, like they have the advantages they have, we can't even hardly comprehend.
Yeah. Think about when it's shed season, you know, I see a lot of it, and we see it too, but you think of deadheads, like how many people find deadheads when they're shed hunting? You know, it's just, there's a lot of deadheads found. And I think what's interesting for me when I shed hunt, I go to places that we've never been before. Like we don't, or not never been before, but don't go any other time of year. And I think when we find those deadheads, it's a reminder of like, make note of it. You know, why do you find so many deadheads in a same similar chunk of woods? It seems like you do year in and year out. And they're not necessarily all shot by us even. Like neighboring properties, deer end up in little pockets. And I go, it's really something that if you don't keep it in the back of your mind, or if you do keep it in the back of your mind and it comes to fall and you make a shot on a deer, you know, like there's a chance that maybe if you're finding consistency with that, that's a spot you should look. And I just think that we get so, myself and the guys I hunt with, we get so touchy about pressure on our farm. And one of the things that I think is a real underestimated value of a tracking dog is how efficient they are and how quickly they can get me into an area to find a dead deer and out. And it's even like, I don't take dogs on just the tracks that I can't find the deer. I take them on every track, whether it's a good shot or not, because it's an experience builder for them. It's a confidence builder in me. It's an ability for me to truly read their body language on the real thing. And it is the most effective way to get in and out of a piece of property with the least amount of fooling around. So, I mean, I've shot deer that like were easy recoveries, did not use a dog, and it turned into 45 minutes to an hour of stepping on. And all of a sudden there it is. Well, if I had a dog, I'm in. And I helped a really good friend of mine who is an outfitter. And I trained a dog for them, and they bring every dog. They bring the dog on every track. The best hits, the worst hits, they bring it on every track. And I can't tell you how efficient we got at getting deer out of the woods. And the clients were just amazed, because they're just like, the clients don't even come with. Like me and my buddy Mark, who is the son of the owner, we would go in with the dog scout that I trained for him, and we would go in and we would be back to the truck dragging in such short time that the clients are just like, how did you in that kind of woods, how did you cover it that quick? And the dog did what it took me maybe 45 minutes. The dog did it in 30 seconds.
Yep.
And so that to me is a value, especially as a hunter, because it allows me to put that much less pressure on prime real estate during a relatively short window of time when we do the majority of our hunting.
Well, yeah. And when you're talking about an outfitter running people through, you know, any way you can minimize impact is a good thing. But also, you know, if you want a recovery dog to develop, you know, that's the ticket. I mean, you've seen, we've all seen the bird dogs that are weekend warriors that get out, you know, on one trip or two trips a season, and they don't really know what they're doing. Right. And, you know, the owners get mad because there's kind of an ego thing going on, but it's like, well, you don't, you know, if there's something you only do like 6 days a year, you're not going to be good at it.
Right. Right. Absolutely. The best pheasant dogs you from a hunting perspective are the ones that are guide dogs. They see so many opportunities. You know, by the time when you get these dogs that hunt a couple weekends a year, by the time the weekend's done, they're just starting to figure it out. And then it might be several weeks before they do it again. And then that might be it for the year. And so, the more you can do, most definitely, the better they're going to get, the more they're going to, because we can only replicate it so much in training. And I think we've come up with ways of doing it pretty effectively. But it's like I said before, it's insulting to think that we're truly going to like challenge the dog when it comes to that kind of stuff. I think training a dog is the one who benefits the most is us in understanding how to figure out when and why the dog is doing certain things. And the real thing is that's where real tracking dogs develop is going on actual tracks, because it takes away our subconscious to cheat for them. Like we can't help them because we don't know where it is. Where if I lay the track I know where the track is, and it's easy for me to try to make myself feel good by positioning them to always succeed. And so if you're going to do it that way, I am a big proponent of the idea of have someone else lay the track. I think you should do it that way, make it easy and set the dog up to succeed to start out with. But then when it comes to challenging, have someone else put it out and you go track it, where you don't necessarily know all the little turns that you put into it. You don't know the little loops or the challenges or the backtracks or the different things that have been thrown at that dog. And it really forces you to be honest.
How are you laying a trail to train?
So I just use a small piece of hide. I make a scent. We call it blood trail, but it's a scent that I make. It's got 13 different scent elements in it that are collected throughout the year. I have a freezer full of stuff that my wife doesn't go into for bread. that one's off limits. That one's my freezer. So I make a scent. I use a real piece of hide. It's very simple. I just don't want to complicate it that much because I think the value that we get out of these, like I said, is in reading the dog. So I simulate it with that scent that I use, that blood trail scent, and I put it on the hide, and the hide acts almost as a sponge. It's a piece of hide that we flesh and dry, and then we offer it as a kit. So we sell like a little drag line and a training booklet and a bottle of scent in this hide. And the hide is an actual deer hide. So we buy deer hides every fall and winter. And then we've got some guys with big forearms. The baseball players are the guys who always flesh our hides for us. So we've got some kids that are in high school that work with us, and they flesh all these hides. And then we cut them into squares. We dry them, and we package them up no different than if you were shipping a hide off to be sold, as a fur buyer. So it will stay, but it's not treated. There's no chemicals, there's no tanning. And then what happens is when you take that hide and you rehydrate it, put it in underwater, it'll start to take a softness back to it, a pliability to it. But then all of a sudden it's got moisture. And when it has moisture, it can create bacteria. When the bacteria start, that's where scent comes from. So we take that in conjunction with this scent that I make. And I have had, it's about as easy of a process as I've seen, but the results are really good. And so there are some guys that are buying special tracking shoes. There's some people that are sold on the idea of interdigital glands and they're using hooves. That's a very European way, traditional way of doing it. I question the need for it. I'm not saying it's wrong, but the amount of effort and work that takes, I don't know that I gain that much from it. So it's more practical for me to do it the way I'm doing it. It's more efficient. It's easier for me to store stuff. It's faster. So I do think that the toughest part about tracking when you're setting up for training, tracking dogs, is you got to understand that, like, you don't just go out and do it. Like it's a two-part process. You have to lay a trail. So there's some thought that goes into that. There's some understanding of the topography and the contours and the land that you're going to be using. And then you got to do that ahead of time. You got to understand the impacts of the elements. And then you got to wait. Because I think a lot of times we get people that lay a trail and then they go get their dog and they track. And like, that's like kiddie play. I mean, that's just, that's fine. You can do that with young dogs, but at some point you have to start aging. You got to start putting some age to that line. You got to let the line break down. You got to let the scent kind of disperse. You got to let things happen naturally, like it would when you're actually tracking a deer. And so if you're going to train a dog to track with a line, it could be a 2 to 3 day process. And you got to remember it. Like, I've laid trails out before and forgot about them. I'm like, oh God, damn, I forgot about that one. So, because life gets busy. So you got to understand that's the challenge there. But you can do some stuff that's real simple at night. Like I'll do it tonight, probably about 8:45, about the last 15 minutes of light. And I'll take tennis balls and I'll take that blood trail scent, which is liquid, and I'll put that on a tennis ball. And then I'll go, and I've got relatively short grass, and I've got lots of different lengths of grass. And I'll take tennis rackets and I'll hit tennis balls down the driveway, down the grass runways. I've got all these mowed strips. I'll hit tennis balls and skip them along the ground. You can use chuckets. I like tennis balls, but or tennis rackets, but you just skip that tennis ball along, and then you cover, you can cover the dog's eyes, you can do all sorts of stuff, and then you can get that dog to the start of the line and tell him find it, and then shut up, and then just let him watch him work. And then, and now all of a sudden I get 10, 15 minutes right before, you know, the reason I do it so late is because it's so hot.
Yep.
But I get some nice cardio work in, forcing the dog to use its nose. Real big reward at the end. Tennis balls are like the big drug for a dog. You gotta be careful, you know, not to use it too much. But boy, they love them. It's just a huge reward. So a very simple little track made very fun. And I often tell people, don't set just trail after trail after trail after trail for your dog. You'll burn them out. Like that's the final exam. Like that, if you're a kid, that's the big test. Where if all we did was send kids to school and the teachers gave them final exams every day, the kids would burn right out. So how do you get prepared for a final exam? With lots of little quizzes and lots of little lessons and lots of little things. You work your way up. And then at the end, you get a test. And I think from a tracking standpoint, there's lots of little creative ways to do lessons and to have quizzes and to do that stuff. And then eventually at the end of the semester, you give them the test and you see how they did.
I love it, buddy. Where can everybody find all your YouTube videos if they're interested in training dogs and your blood trailing, blood tracking, game recovery products, bud?
Dogbone Hunter for everything. So Dogbone Hunter is our YouTube, our Instagram, Facebook, our podcast. Everything is just at Dogbone Hunter. So it's relatively easy. Yeah, everybody's using those channels, and we are making a real big effort to try to. I love it because it's such an easy, effective way for us to share information. And we're putting a ton of effort into it, and hopefully we're really designed, or we do things to try to help those that are interested in training their own dogs. And if that's where I feel like our value comes.
Awesome, man. Well, thank you so much for coming on, buddy.
I appreciate it as always.
That's it for this episode of Wired to Hunt. I'm your host, Tony Peterson. I should say I'm your guest host, Tony Peterson, but I think you'll hear me around here a little bit more. As always, thank you so much for listening. If you're not subscribed, please subscribe. If you're not listening to my Foundations podcast, listen to that as well. But thank you so much for checking in. We really appreciate it, and we will see you here next week.